to SER's Arts and Culture Show.
Don't make me say it's so hot right now.
Caliente, ahora!
Your weekly dose of arts and culture.
And all of that sort of stuff.
It's that weird thing that they're classics because they're classics because they're classics, and then they become the classics and everyone wants to do the classics because they're classics.
He's amazing.
Well, you need a lot of room for all that blood.
And he's hot as a firecracker.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now. You better not use me saying that.
Amazing babes.
On 2SER 107.3.
Good morning and welcome to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture. And before we get started, I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people who are the traditional custodians of this land from which we are broadcasting. I would also like to pay my respect to elders past, present and emerging from the Eora Nation. So it is so hot right now today. So 11 till 12, I have a show full of all things arts and culture. I have the absolute pleasure of speaking with Bronwyn Bancroft from Bumali. She is one of the co-founders of the Aboriginal Cooperative in Leichhardt, which is nothing short of a highly influential and iconic institution in Sydney. So stay tuned because we are chatting about healing ourselves, healing our country. That is a little bit later on the show. I'm also speaking with Nasra Latif Quesh, who is has a solo exhibition at 4A Centre for Contemporary Asian Art at the moment entitled Strategies of Intent, which is an absolutely breathtaking show exploring a few different things, some of which being weaponry as well as colonisation and the museological convention of collecting and ownership. So it's a really interesting show. I highly recommend you check that out. But first up, I am speaking with Sydney comedian and writer and IBIS advocate Beck Melrose, who is talking about her latest Sydney Fringe Festival show, Big Dolphin Energy. So stay with us to get us there. I am going to play one of probably my favorite songs. I'm super, super late to the party, but this is Lizzo with Juice. You are tuned into So Hot Right Now.
Yeah.
voice, my skin, my logo. How you tryna package me when you don't got a photo? In the end, no ID, no polo. Shout into the heavens, cause I don't know where to go to. Somebody tell the dealer I'm coming. I'm coming. My oh my, nah, I'm stunning. My oh my, nah, I'm running in the end, so here I go. We used to think the industry was five stars, and now we itching just to find stars, to find stars. But they were scheming when they find us, to find us. And now we talking, now we open, so they remind us from the beginning. We never win it. Then when I in this, we just buy. You want my art? What's hot? What's that? I'm under charge and overthought. Now I'm living, trying to give in every melody of ours. What's hot, what's not, what's ours? Sally selling six figures where we meant to. Nice. I'm trying to make a living. Music is a source of all my end and my beginning singing.
There is a new one from Sampa the Great. That is her track Freedom, which is part of a small series of singles she's just released, all of which I've probably already played and highly recommend. And up the top there was Lizzo with Juice off her album 'Cause I Love You. Right now we are talking about Big Dolphin Energy, which is a fringe show that I'm not totally sure I can explain. So here to do it for me is comedian and writer of the show, Beck Melrose. Good morning, Beck.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Nicole.
No problem. Anytime. So first off, probably the best place to start is how come you named your show Big Dolphin Energy and what is Big Dolphin Energy?
What is Big Dolphin Energy? That's a philosophical question. I named my show Big Dolphin Energy because when I was in Melbourne, I was hanging out with one of my mates and she just casually asked me one day, "Were you the dolphin girl at school?" And I was really taken aback and I said, "Yeah, I was. How come?" And she said, "Oh, you've just got big dolphin energy." And I thought, geez, nothing has resonated with me quite like that in a long time.
What is the dolphin girl at school? Like a mascot thing? Or?
I just love dolphins. I've always loved dolphins and whales.
There's always,
there's always one.
Like
right?
A marine kind of person.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to be a marine biologist until I realized that I'd just spend my entire career knee deep in algae. So I gave up on that. Killed my childhood dreams.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the show? You have a background kind of doing drag as well as building characters. What can we expect from Big Dolphin Energy in terms of format?
Yeah, not that. It's a bit of a departure from what I've done. My last show was about an ibis trying to connect with Sydney siders and talking about the struggle of urban wildlife. This is just me as me talking about complexities of modern life, I think. It's a full hour of stand-up, my first full hour of stand-up.
So do you embody the dolphin? Because Big Dolphin Energy resonates with you kind of thing? Not a physical dolphin, but is that kind of why it's more not character-based, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I guess I embody the dolphin in ways I probably don't even notice. If other people are picking up on it, I guess that energy's just there. It's in my aura.
That makes sense.
Big dolphin aura.
So you recently went to Hobart and have performed in other comedy rooms across Australia. How does the Sydney scene compare to other scenes?
I've definitely spent most of my time in the Sydney scene. It's super friendly. I mean, I've been doing stand-up for a bit over a year now, and I've felt really welcomed. There are a lot of rooms that are popping up now where there's a community around it as well. Queens of Comedy's one, What She Said and Tuesday Tonic, really good rooms where diverse voices are invited and encouraged, and I think it's great. It's awesome to be a part of.
What has encouraged your shift from kind of drag and character work to just straight stand-up? Is that at all kind of emphasised by the scene that you're in or anything like that?
I guess when I entered Raw Comedy last year, and since then I've been writing stand-up for the first time, and I'm really enjoying it. I started in improv at Improv Theatre Sydney, so that's naturally, I think, where a lot of the character stuff came from. And since I've been doing stand-up, I've just been really keen to try and pull together an hour. So finally doing it, year later.
How has the experience been making that transition? Is it more daunting to do stand-up than it is to do other kinds of work?
I personally find improv really, really challenging, and I'm always in awe of sitting down and watching people that can improvise really well. So I think for me, I kind of think of that as like a medicine ball for comedy for me, and it makes stand-up a little bit easier having that training.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it almost seems a bit of a natural progression.
Yeah, I think so.
So Big Dolphin Energy, back to the show. What kind of would you like people to take away from seeing your show? Is there a kind of central message or anything?
You know what? I think if people can come out, have a laugh, have a good time, I've done my job. I just want people to have a good time. There might be a central message. There might be some kind of narrative arc that emerges. I guess we'll find out when I finish writing the show.
Or when you attend.
Yes, exactly.
And lastly, what advice would you give to any comedians who are just starting out?
Oh, man, I'm going to go full Brené Brown here. I've got to be careful. Just do it. If you're thinking about starting comedy or you're starting out, go and find a couple of rooms where you feel really comfy and just give it a shot. I think the best way, it's one of those things, the best way to learn in comedy is just through doing it and humiliation. And humiliation is an amazing teacher. You'll learn very quickly, but you just got to get out there and do it. There's no other way around it.
Have you been humiliated many times?
Oh, man, it's like the byline of this job. Yes, I have so much. There's nothing quite like standing on stage trying to make people laugh and them absolutely not having a bar of it. But
sounds,
you get over it pretty quick.
Like nightmare fuel.
Yeah, it really is.
Cool. Well, I look forward to seeing Big Dolphin Energy. Thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
No worries. That was Beck Melrose on Big Dolphin Energy, which is her upcoming show you can catch at the Factory Theatre on the 24th, 26th and 28th of September as part of the Sydney Fringe Comedy Festival. You can find all the details relevant on our show page if you look for So Hot Right Now on the 2SCR website. Right now, I'm going to play a track from Matt Cetus. This is A Dream. You are tuned into So Hot Right Now.
We'll be right back. Following her sellout performances for Vivid Live in 2018, Grammy Award-winning R&B superstar Solange returns to Sydney Opera House this January for four exclusive Australian performances. Set to reignite audiences with a stunning new 360-degree visual set and songs from her critically acclaimed new record, When I Get Home. Book now for Solange, January 2020, at sydneyoperahouse.com. Sponsors of 2SER. Join one of the world's top 10 drama schools and train with the best at the National Institute of Dramatic Art. Pairing collaborative, practical training with valuable industry connections, NIDA offers studies in acting, musical theatre, costume, directing, production, makeup, design, scenic construction, and more. Applications for master's, bachelor, and diploma courses are now open to start in 2020. Head to apply.nida.edu.au. NIDA sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Hello and welcome back to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture. That track there was from Matt Sidders out of Sydney, A Dream, off 707's and Hell and Heaven. And if you missed my last chat there, I spoke with comedian Beck Melrose all about her upcoming show, Big Dolphin Energy, at the Fringe Festival. And up next, we are talking about Strategies of Intent. This breathtaking exhibition questions, interrogates, and illuminates the museological convention of collecting and ownership. I'm going to play a track to get us there. This one is from Katie Tatham. This is Sugar off their album Serious Times. You are tuned into So Hot Right Now. is out of the UK. That is Caddy Tatnam with Sugar off Serious Times, which a friend just sent me this morning, and it is, I'm obsessed with it. It's wonderful. It's a great four-track EP / album, maybe. Anyway, you are tuned into So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture on 2SCR 107.3. And right now I am talking about Strategies of Intent, which presents an investigation into the symbolism and assumptions embedded in art history. This stunning solo exhibition from Nasra Latif Quresh beautifully attempts to undermine, shift, and reimagine historical imagery. Strategies of Intent functions like a warning for the contemporary age, where assumed realities can be little more than constructed visions. I spoke with Nasra earlier this week about her work, process, and practice.
So this exhibition can be described as an investigation into elements of art history. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're investigating through Strategies of Intent?
In this show, I think the aim was to explore my responses to certain collections of arms and armor that I have seen over the years, especially as a child, in my hometown of Lahore. What had fascinated and horrified me as a child still fascinates me, I think. The display of arms and different kinds of weapons that belong to an era that we almost cannot imagine in these times, where carrying weapons was part of life, and a lot of these collections actually commemorate certain historical battles and even wars. So my aim was to, in a way, analyze visually that fear and that cusp of violence and beauty, as most of these weapons are heavily decorated, heavily ornamental, as well as functional. So this strange interjunction of death and beauty is what fascinates me visually. But then conceptually, how one group of people has confiscated or looted the weapons of another culture, basically defeating them in a battle and then capturing those objects as a trophy, displayed as a trophy.
So you mentioned that you were fascinated by the idea of weaponry from a young age, from a child. Can you tell us a little bit more about your experiences of viewing these kinds of works in your younger years?
I think the main feeling that still remains is that of fear, and that these weapons in these showcases, they carry a certain story which is not told, but then it's obvious in a certain way. So that particular moment is still somewhere, it's alive somewhere that I can think of. And it is not about glorifying weaponry, but it's about what stories those objects have to tell, that once they were part of a bloody interaction between two opposing groups. And they were both aiming for the same goal. My part as an artist is to investigate that moment, I think. That is the part that fascinates me.
Can you tell us about your process of undergoing this investigation and how you came to realize the work in Strategies of Intent?
I think the first step was lots of research. And that is usually how I work with any project. So I do lots of historical research, because I work with existing historical content and their stories, existing artworks, existing art histories, and historical facts, or what are considered facts. I find that going through that process enriches my understanding of what that object is about and its controversies. So I collect lots of images then, text, or any work, something that has been written about it, where that object was exhibited, who did what, all those sorts of facts that usually unravel quite interesting connections. Like, for example, I looked at a particular collection in Museums Victoria storage, a set of weapons that came from India in 1859. The weapons were confiscated from the mutineers. So the British like to call it the mutiny. And in India, or in Indian historical context, it is War of Independence, the first War of Independence. There you have a conflict already, an interesting contextual understanding. So looking at that collection made me realize a lot of things about who owns what and how those weapons ended up only 2 years after that war in Melbourne, which was one of the remotest places from India, let's say. So it wasn't, if it would have happened 10 years later, that would be kind of normal for that time span of that era. But only 2 years later, so they were confiscated, put on a ship, landed in Melbourne and displayed in the public library in Melbourne then, along with Aboriginal weapons.
Yeah, the idea of, you know, stolen works and stolen artifacts comes up a lot in the art world. Are you responding to that kind of ongoing crisis through strategies of intent?
I think part of it is that it does address that area. The idea of not owning things anymore, of belonging, and then another bigger picture, a bigger problem, let's say, of categorizing things according to a certain ideology or from a certain perspective. So this idea that you can put certain things in certain categories and then you kind of control them. So I'm challenging that as well. And then absence in the work downstairs, which is called the House of Irredeemable Objects, where you don't see anything. It's an empty showcase with just the impressions of weapons that were displayed. There is nothing there to see. So it comments on that idea of deprivation almost of a whole civilization deprived of its own production, taken out of context.
As well as the absence of objects, there's also a lot of objects in the show, and some I'm particularly interested are in a work that has different crystals as well as a kind of fur object. Can you tell us a little bit about the objects that you've used and what they represent?
This work, which is called The Inventory of Noble Causes, it is an inventory of things that probably meant very different things to different people. For me, I see it as an exercise in indexation to list the objects that perhaps don't mean anything separately. They are not of any historical value, but then they point towards certain desires, certain intentions that perhaps the colonizers had. Most of these objects in the showcase have, which is made to look like a museum vitrine, but without it any legs. So it's sitting very uncomfortably on the ground, and the viewer has to look down upon it. It is full of objects which have some European association. So there is that ceramic figurine which shows a couple in idyllic background. And then in front of that, we have a teeny little brass sculpture of a Ganesh. Then we have a coronation Bible in red leather. And these crystals are not exactly precious stone, so they are the second or B-grade kind of semi-precious stones, let's say. So all of these objects have a bit of an approximation of the real thing, not the exact thing, but a substitute, almost a substitute, or indicating, pointing towards the intention of acquiring the riches from the colonized lands. So there is a jade bowl in there, some glass, there's a glass orb and some silver objects, and a brass container which has shells which were used as a currency. But the shells also point towards a few metaphors or sayings in Urdu language, which translate as that you have sold something for pittance, something that was worth much more. So you sold it for cowries, which was worth millions. And then another one which translates as worth two cowries, which is like, it doesn't mean anything. It's such a useless little thing. So it's not even worth that much. So they're two different meanings using the same vehicle of the currency. And then the fur is perhaps a ferret or a couple of ferrets joined together to be worn as a scarf, and it comes from Europe. And then there is a tapestry which shows a young woman reading a book, perhaps a red covered Bible, or perhaps something more interesting for her, because she seems to be enjoying it too much and smiling when she's reading it. So these objects are in a way an indication towards something that perhaps existed. So I want to leave that a bit unclear and not pin it down too much.
So central to strategies of intent is kind of this reworking of history. How does this function in a contemporary context?
I think history in general is avoided by us in modern societies. We do not want to acknowledge that something similar has happened or is likely to happen again. We do not wish to acknowledge the past because it raises up many uncomfortable questions and patterns that can be repeated again and again. So it has been my intention in most of my works to recall parts of history that are perhaps uncomfortable but very relevant to what is happening now, especially in politics, and how politics has certain ideologies going on but using a different jargon but with similar intentions of misusing resources of certain parts of the world but calling it something more noble than that.
That there was Nusra Latif Qureshi talking about Strategies of Intent, which is Nusra's first solo institutional exhibition in Australia. You can catch her work at 4A Centre for Contemporary Asian Art from now until September 29th. There's also a series of public programs put on at 4A. Today is the first of those. At 2 p.m. there is a panel discussion entitled Please Explain, Do Colonial Objects Still Hold Power? That's free to register, free to go to, just register online. We'll put all the relevant details for that up on our show page. Next up, art is proven to be a major contributor to assisting with a number of overwhelming pressures in our world. Art and the act of making it is a vehicle for creativity and healing. That there is a quote from Bronwyn Bancroft, a co-founder of Bumali Aboriginal Artists Cooperative. I have the absolute pleasure of speaking with Bronwyn right after the break, talking all about Bumali's upcoming show, which she has curated. So stay tuned. That is coming up next. I'm going to take a track from Lady Ray. This is Come On In. You are tuned into So Hot Right Now.
My hand.
welcome back to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture on 2SER 107.3. That there was a track from Bread Club, a Sydney-based band who are playing tonight at the Factory Theatre. And right now I'm talking about Bumali Aboriginal Artists Cooperative, which has existed since 1987 and is one of their key objectives is to promote Aboriginal artists whose language groups exist within the New South Wales state boundaries. This iconic organisation was founded by a few different influential artists, including Tracy Moffat, Fiona Folly, Brenda L. Croft, and Bronwyn Bancroft. This morning, I am absolutely delighted to be joined by Bronwyn, the curator of Healing Ourselves, Healing Our Country, which is the latest exhibition from Bumali exploring the therapeutic power of art. Good morning, Bronwyn.
Good morning.
So can you start? So Healing Ourselves, Healing Our Country explores the healing properties of art. What inspired you to illuminate and celebrate this particular aspect of art making?
I think in particular it's because I can see the benefits in community over the last 33 years since Bumali's been in existence of the power of creation and people being able to transform something, nothing to something, and be able to actually continuously strengthen their family stories and become empowered by the fact that they might even be able to make some income. So it's really about the act of creating itself that we're exploring. As I've said to the artist, just produce something that made you happy, if that's what you're feeling. So, you know, something that was good for you. So, and the show's starting to look really excellent. So very proud of them all.
So in your experience working both as an artist and a curator, what role does creating art play for you in helping to alleviate things like intergenerational stress or anxiety?
Well, you know, they're very broad brushstrokes that you're using in terms of that. It's extremely hard to actually be forensic about the benefits of anything except the power of wanting to make change. So largely, I don't actually deem myself to be a curator. I'm an artist who assists other people to explore their work and actually provide a venue for people to show their work. But largely, the curatorial elements of being able to bring a show to life aren't that interesting to me. What's interesting to me is actually looking at it from an artist's perspective and saying, wow, look at the cultivation of that artist and what they've managed to be able to grab from, you know, the rationale around what we're all thinking. And Australian, like Aboriginal people in Australia are still under siege, and it's going to be 250-year anniversary of Cook. So 160,000 by 250, and we're still under siege. We've got the greatest incarceration rates. We've got the greatest intergenerational trauma. We can't get successive funding at Bumali or multi-year funding at Bumali to support our artists. And 50% of our artists live in regional areas which are riddled with racism. So, you know, while we may have many successful Aboriginal people living in the upper echelons of all of the art society in Australia, we have a very large percentage of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are living in a very, very, very low socioeconomic bracket. And that needs to be challenged as well. Why would a 33-year-old cooperative like Bumali not get multi-year funding from a government when Aboriginal people are still under siege in terms of the way our standard of living and life expectancy exists? These are the questions that I want answered. Which is one of the reasons why I'm doing this show.
Yeah, it's Bumali. Nothing short of a disgrace.
Nothing short of a disgrace, but it's also our own people that have to step up to the plate and say, look, why are we being the gatekeepers on this? You know, who are we to say that we're not going to give, you know, funding to this organisation that's been, we are one of the oldest arts institutions in the country run by Aboriginal people. It's really kind of kooky. So, as you can probably tell, I don't make a lot of friends when I'm advocating in this sphere. But at the end of the day, I'm not here to make people comfortable. I'm here to participate in the uncomfortable conversations that need to be had because we're not moving. You know, percentages of our community are moving, but a really vast majority of our mob are still, you know, languishing under this terrible, you know, situation that we have with racism that's just alive and well in Australia.
I couldn't agree more.
Mm.
This exhibition is, yeah, very much set against that stage, against the stage of political turbulence in Australia and ongoing racism and incarceration, all those things you mentioned. How important is art and the act of creating in kind of instilling maybe just a small sense of happiness and well-being in your small Bumala community or the wider community?
Oh, look, I think it's incalculable what art does for the soul. I mean, you know, as I just was writing a grant application, another grant application, I'm like, it's one of the things that you can't, I mean, Aboriginal people didn't have a word for art. I mean, it was so incorporated in the socioeconomic systems and ecosystems of our culture that it's this distraction and the distinction that now comes from the creation of art is quite elitist, I think. And basically art, as far as I'm concerned, which it's my opinion only, is really the bedrock of all humanity, because I believe fundamentally that if people have the ability to create, we are a happier society, we are a happier group of people, we can work together in solidarity to create images and social activism, we can advocate through art, and the healing properties are beyond anything that we could calculate. And largely you could look at a kindergarten class to see how passionate they are about art and creation, then go to high school art and see the abject disappointment that a majority of people have when they're doing art, because, you know, you've got to do finance, you've got to do IT, you've got to do economics, you've got to do commerce, but you can't do anything creative because it's not seen as a proper career. But I believe as automation and the digital economies take over, art and the creative industries are going to become more and more important as time goes by.
100%. I'm really interested in, as you alluded to before, in putting together this show, you kind of, it sounds like you collaborated with all your artists in helping produce work. Can you tell us a little bit more about who you've selected and the process of putting the show together?
I don't do a selection process because I believe one of the things that's fundamentally undone the whole of the Aboriginal art scene since 1987, when I was trying to fight for the rights of Aboriginal people to be involved in major exhibitions, et cetera, is that we now are dominated by a star system where the same artists are continuously picked to represent at national levels. What we do at Bumala generally is that we allow everyone to come, and it's never positioned as an elitist organisation, and we're about helping people to help themselves. We want people to know that they're not going to get judged. Oh, wow, you know, oh, that's not good enough. Well, you know, we don't want to talk to people that way. So basically anyone can exhibit. It's a members-based exhibition. So basically, you know, most of the members bring in work and respond to the rationale, but no one's going to be denied access to put their work up. So there's no instructional leaflet and there's no, you're not good enough. We're here to help each other. We're not here to judge each other.
Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the specific artists and specific works that are on display?
Well, Nagina Dixon's going to do some. She's just doing some wonderful. She does amazing work. So she's a Gadigal woman, but she's incredible. Graham Toomey's got some work in here. Euphemia Bostock has done a piece about macular degeneration. She's one of our elders, and she's recently experienced loss of sight, and so she's painted a painting about that. And how she's dealing with that. And then we've got Danielle Garogo, who's done the Healing Waters. We've got their full lineup. Got Deborah Beal, and I'm looking at them as I go through. Jasmine Farron, who's become a very, you know, go-getty girl in our cooperative. So we've got probably about 30 artists, maybe, that we're going to be exhibiting with one or two pieces each. each. And Jeffrey Samuels, the work's looking great. I'm just standing in the gallery now looking at it because we just have it placed around the wall. And the Yoraba, I'm putting some Yoraba Paper Company in as well because they do all their handmade paper and they deal with Boobaroo Lagoon in far north New South Wales, and they're amazing, a group of people that have been going for, you know, quite a long time and wonderful artists.
Can you give us just a little bit of an indication of what's coming up next for Bumali after this exhibition?
We're hoping to, well, one of our curators, fortunately and unfortunately, was successful in getting an encounters fellowship with the National Museum of Australia. So she's taking quite a lot of time out to go to England to study the collections there, and also she's now placed down at the National Museum for a period of 3 weeks. So the next show that we're having is a member show, and it'll be called Alchemy and Anarchy, and it's basically looking at the magic of Aboriginal art to fight against social injustice, and then the anarchy, which is, I think, you know, Adam Hill, people like that would fit into the anarchy element of, like, let's just keep fighting and questioning, you know, government control and the perception around Aboriginal art. So it splits into the two ways that we can approach things.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining me on the show this morning. Both exhibitions sound absolutely incredible.
Thanks very much.
No problems.
Have a great day.
You too.
I will. See ya. Bye.
So if you'd like to check out the exhibition, it opens on the 28th of August and will be running until the 20th of October at Bumali Aboriginal Artists Cooperative in Leichhardt. You can check out our show page to find any relevant links to that. And I highly recommend you get out there and support Bumali. It's one of Sydney's most important institutions, or not even an institution, cooperative, that it's really important that you support Bumali to keep them going. So everyone get yourself down there. And that is just about all the time I have on the show today. So I'm just going to finish with a track. Unfortunately, we won't be able to hear all of it, but this is Wicked Beat Sound System with Dreaming Finale. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone.